listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. People-powered radio. Time now for Disability in Progress.
This is KFAI, 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, and KFAI.org.
I just said that.
Disability in Progress is up next. Disability in Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam, the host of this show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Aaron is our podcaster. Charlene Dahl is our research PR woman. Hello, Charlene.
Good evening, everybody.
I want to remind you that if you want to be on our email list, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. That's disability and progress, all written out, at samjasmine.com. This week, we'll be speaking with Dr. Jeremy Vantoff. Dr. Vantoff is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School and a cardiologist with mHealth Fairview. Dr. Vantoff, research interest involves improving cardiovascular disease detection and early intervention. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Vantoff.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I want to start out by asking you, what are the most common heart conditions that affect adults?
Yeah, I think you can think about this in a few different ways. One of the most common things that can happen to kind of injure someone's heart is a buildup of cholesterol plaque in the heart arteries that supply blood and oxygen to the heart muscle. And that can weaken the heart muscle. And over time, that can result in chest pains or a decreased pumping function of the heart, called heart failure. What I'm talking about here is called ischemic cardiomyopathy. Mm-hmm. And I think another very common, more electrical problem that can happen with the heart is a arrhythmia called atrial fibrillation. So between ischemic cardiomyopathy, heart failure, and atrial fibrillation, I think that covers some of the most common things you'll find with heart disease.
So when you get something like that, how does that these kind of heart conditions impact daily life and overall health?
Yeah, good question. It can vary quite a bit from person to person, depending on how severe the disease is or how active of a life that they're used to. The impact, I think, can vary quite a bit, but symptoms can include, you know, chest discomfort or shortness of breath with minimal activity, or lightheadedness or palpitations or just general fatigue.
So what are some of the things that can make someone develop heart disease?
So the most common risk factors for heart disease in general, and specifically for that cholesterol, you know, buildup heart type of heart disease, I think about them in three or four major categories for traditional risk factors, which include high blood pressure, mm-hmm. elevated cholesterol, history of diabetes, and smoking.
Ah.
But I think it's really important to acknowledge that there are a lot of other factors that could contribute to heart disease, including what underlies much of those risk factors that I discussed, which is how you eat, how much you move, mm-hmm. how much chronic stress you might experience. We are kind of recognizing and acknowledging the impact of poor sleep on heart health. Mm-hmm. So there are many factors.
What about family history? How does that affect the likelihood of developing heart disease or a heart condition?
Yeah, good question. Genetics certainly play a role in the likelihood of someone developing disease. However, I think it's really important to note, and there are studies that show that by maintaining a healthy lifestyle, one is able to offset much of the impact that the genetics might have on their risk.
Oh, that's a nice idea.
Yeah, so I think it is hopeful that this isn't, you know, a hopeless, you're destined to have heart disease. People are actually able to offset a lot of that risk.
By exercise and eating right?
Correct.
So it sounds like, I mean, you know, what I hear is like exercise plays into so much. Does it really play that much into, let's say, like, you have a family history of maybe your grandparents had several heart attacks, but they were smokers and they drank. And how much does that play into, you know, them having that heart disease? And then how much can you avoid that just by exercise? It sounds like, you know, that would be hard to measure, but is it?
Yeah, it is hard to measure, I would say. But certainly if your grandparents had a lifestyle or risk factors like smoking or, you know, like an unhealthy diet that you are able to not participate in, not become a smoker or stop smoking if you do smoke, and start eating healthy, especially at a young age, and continue maintaining that through adulthood, you are able to offset much of that risk that might be related to genetics.
Excellent. I need to take just a short station break, and I'll be right back.
People say we're made up.
That dragons,
merpeople,
and unicorns like me are nothing more than a myth.
Believe what you want about us, but in the Twin Cities, recycling is real, and it works.
The items you put in your cart get recycled when you recycle right.
Recycling exists! Learn the real story behind recycling at recyclingexists.com.
You're tuned to KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. This is Disability in Progress. We're speaking with Dr. Jeremy Van Toff, and we are talking about adult heart conditions. I want to address that I have heard a lot in the news lately about alcohol increasing cancer rates, which I might tell you disappoints me greatly because I like my glass of wine once in a while. How much does alcohol increase heart problems?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I think in the past, you know, people may have heard that maybe red wine is good for the heart or certain ways to consume alcohol are beneficial. And as you said, more lately, the messaging is that no amount of alcohol is safe, right? I think that's what we're hearing a little bit more often. And it's difficult to, you know, assess that with heart disease because we're never going to have a study where you tell one group to drink and one group not to drink alcohol, right?
So. Boy, wouldn't that be interesting.
So it's difficult to assess, but I think one thing that we do see that's clear is excess amounts of alcohol can increase risk of heart failure specifically. And this is a problem where the actual alcohol that is in your body is toxic to the cells of the heart. And again, it's clear that some people are more susceptible to that and others are not. We're not very good at predicting that type of susceptibility at this time. But I would say that excess is a risk for heart failure. What is a safe amount? I don't think it's very clear. I think that's why we kind of start to hear that, you know, the best amount is zero, because that's, you know, there's safety in that.
Right. What about other, like, populations or demographics? Are there certain populations of people that are more prone to heart conditions than others? How does that work, or what are you seeing?
Yeah. So we collect a lot of data on what, and by we, I mean, you know, the CDC and American Heart Association and others collect data on who gets heart disease over time. And we observe patterns in different populations of higher, and where we notice higher amounts of heart disease. But I think it's important to note that much of the time, these patterns of higher heart disease in different races or ethnicities is a result of non-genetic or non-race-based issues, like, do you have access to healthy food? Mm-hmm. You know, what is your, you know, economic status? Or do you live in a high-stress situation? Do you have stable housing? You know, these determinants, these what we call social determinants of health, are important and are not necessarily the same amount of a problem across all race ethnicities. So I think that when thinking about patterns of disease, that's an important factor to consider. We do know that there are certain specific genetic heart diseases that can be found in different, you know, specific populations. One people group that is getting a little more attention in terms of heart disease risk is the Southeast Asian population, where we tend to see higher risk of diabetes and high blood pressure at younger ages.
Really? Huh.
Yeah.
And how about gender, like females or males? Is there a higher risk in certain diseases for heart problems for females as opposed to males, or vice versa?
What we tend to see is that women develop heart disease, specifically, you know, blood vessel heart disease, a little bit later in life than men. And that's thought to do that's thought to be due to different hormones. And so after menopause, you really see that the cardiovascular risk in women catches up to men.
Oh, I see. Those darn hormones. What are some of the early warning signs of a problem or heart disease that people should be looking out for?
Yeah, that's a great question. And what that looks like may be different for different people. So the most classic sign of heart disease or decreased blood flow is chest pain, right? Often it's a pressure in the chest, specifically with activity, and it goes away when you rest. And now that is the most common symptom of blood flow restrictions to the heart muscle, mm-hmm. but there are many other things, many other ways that it can manifest, like shortness of breath or a decrease in exercise tolerance that is kind of unexpected or it could be gradual over time. You know, last summer you could bike 10 miles. This summer you could only go 2 and you have to stop for a rest. You know, those might be signs of a heart-related problem. Other people have discomfort in other areas besides the chest, like their back or their arm or their neck. So it's hard to pinpoint, you know, a specific symptom because many of those things also come and go from people that are not related to heart disease, right?
Right.
And but I think, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
But I think if it's something that, a symptom that's new and especially a symptom that's related to exercise mm-hmm. or physical activity is something that you should pay attention to.
And I'm wondering, like, you know, you gave an example where it was, you know, a more extreme example where somebody might be biking one summer at 10, you know, for several miles and then the next summer they can't make it near as far. Do you think that more goes for, you know, when the weather's nice, everyone gets out and does stuff, and then for those people who live in colder climates, if they hunker down, that has time to have issues set in and then they notice it the next summer? Or can it really come upon you that quickly?
Oh, you can certainly have changes in symptoms from one year to the next. That's due to progression of heart disease, yes. One thing I tell patients is if you're worried that you're just out of shape, right? And that's mm-hmm. why you feel poorly, then you should start to feel better and better as you do more and more exercise, right?
Yes.
That's an indication that, okay, there's some deconditioning here. I'm getting stronger now. I'm going further and feeling better. But if you continue to hit a wall, or especially if it gets worse as you continue to exercise, then that's something that you should, you should pay attention to.
Can you talk about some heart conditions that could be asymptomatic?
Yeah. So even with the most common heart disease, which is the cholesterol buildup, resulting in decreased blood flow and oxygen to the heart muscle, even that, you may not have any symptoms of that cholesterol buildup for years and years until it becomes quite significantly, you know, narrowed, which is why I think in my clinic and in general, I think it's super important to talk about prevention.
Ah, yes. You know,
because often once there are symptoms, the disease has progressed quite significantly. But if we're able to start making changes earlier in life, then you can slow down that progression of disease. Most heart disease develops slowly over time. It doesn't often just, you know, what, 0 yesterday and you know, severe
yeah.
today. So the prevention part is a very important part of managing heart disease and heart disease risk and heart health. I like to talk about heart health rather than heart disease, and maintaining health rather than treating disease.
So obviously when you've been diagnosed, depending on the severity, it could lead to limits of mobility or a disability. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, certainly that's true. And most of the time the symptoms would be related, you know, to fatigue or shortness of breath. That would be the most common limitation, mm-hmm. Versus like a weakness or something like that. But yeah, I would say it would be kind of a conditioning or a fatigue issue that we'd see most commonly that could really restrict people's ability to function.
You know, and this leaves me to somewhere I've always been curious about is about when people have a heart attack. You know, you hear about that, and then what? I feel like there's a recovery time. There's rehab or physical therapy that they might do, or can they get back to what they were? Can they get back to better than they were? Or will they always be hindered because of that heart attack? It's like that's pushing them over the boundary of ever being able to be and do what you used to do.
Yeah, great question. So again, very variable for different people, and people are going to have different experiences with this. But I would say that the earlier that we can catch a problem, the more likely that someone will come back to their full, you know, full potential or full capacity. Specifically with heart attacks, treatment now where we can go in and open up vessels, mm-hmm. and use it to, you know, to make sure those vessels stay open. When that happens quickly, much of the at-risk muscle cells of the heart can recover function. And as you pointed out, sometimes people can even come back to a higher level of functioning because, you know, this sometimes is a wake-up call that, okay, this, you know, this major event just happened. I'm going to get out and exercise a little bit more. I'm going to change my diet. I'm going to, you know, cut out some of these bad habits. And they could potentially come back to an even better place. But on the other hand, there are people who, you know, have significant damage to the heart muscle, and they develop problems with the pump function of the heart, and it can lead to long-term problems. So I think it is it's variable, and you know, I think it's good to acknowledge that different people have, you know, experienced this different ways.
So it sounds like it just depends how much damage that particular instance may cause.
That's right. Yeah, and the speed at which you work to fix it, right? So the longer the symptoms go on and maybe aren't taken care of or aren't acknowledged, I think the higher risk you are at long-term damage.
Since we're on the topic of heart attacks right now, there are differences, I'm told, between what symptoms a male might have when they're having one and what a female might have. Are you in a position to go through that?
Yeah, sure. That is true.
It's not guaranteed, right? But it's common that can happen.
Right. And still the most common symptom of a heart attack for men and for women is chest discomfort. So that's important, you know, because you don't want to go the other way and say, oh, well, you know, women don't as often get chest pain. So if it's chest pain, it's something, and blow it off, you know. So it's really important to still acknowledge that chest pain is the most common symptom. However, you're right in that women are more likely than men to have a different type of symptom than chest discomfort. And this could include neck pain, back pain, arm pain, jaw pain, fatigue, shortness of breath, palpitations, you know, which is a big list, right?
So
other things that should be considered, or when those symptoms happen, heart disease should be considered. And I think too often it's not considered.
I don't want to risk that someone's going to every little pain say, oh my God, am I having a heart attack? So what should they, like, let's say you're having some neck pain or arm pain. What does that feel like, kind of? Like, what else, besides that they might have a pain somewhere, what should they watch for next that might say, oh, you know, this is something more than just a stiff arm or a pain in my neck? Pardon the pun.
Good question. Yeah, I don't want to cause mass panic, of course, but so I would say that, you know, pain or discomfort that changes with, you know, your position or with a certain movement or it gets worse when you stretch a certain way. You know, all of these that indicate more of a musculoskeletal issue. You know, less likely to be the heart. If the symptom gets worse when you do activity and it gets better with your when you rest, that's more indicative of a cardiovascular related symptom. When it's accompanied by other more traditional heart-related things like shortness of breath, or you get really sweaty, you know, when the pain comes on, those are things to keep in mind if you're thinking about heart disease.
Could you have had a heart attack before and not know it or realize that that's what it was and then carry on, so to speak? Or is it something that if you have it, you're going to know and you're going to, it's not going to get better? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Most people have symptoms. Most people have something that they experience that's new and is resulting from, you know, the heart attack. There are some people who either have no symptoms or have such minor symptoms that they kind of ignore it, mm-hmm. and, you know, and it can cause some damage to the heart muscle. Usually this occurs when the amount of heart muscle that's affected is small. You know, the bigger the area that's affected, the more muscle that's not getting enough blood and oxygen, the more likely you're going to have significant symptoms. So we do certainly see there's even a term called silent heart attacks. Mm-hmm. That does happen, but most of the time there will be symptoms.
What are some misconceptions about heart disease?
Good question. Well, I might turn it to you. Are there things that you've heard that you wonder about?
I think for me, the biggest thing I've heard was that, you know, the couple biggest things, and you did address, was like, well, if you have this that run in your family, you have a pretty high chance of having the same things, or in regards to heart stuff, or that once you do have a heart attack, that pushes you over the edge and you'll never be the same. Couple things are what I feel like I've heard. I don't know. Charlene is on here with us, my PR person. I don't know if you've heard anything different that you wonder about, Charlene, but, you know, those are things I have.
Yeah. To that point, I think, you know, heart disease is not inevitable. For everyone, just because your parent or your grandparent or someone, you know, had a heart problem. It's kind of hard to explain without, you know, graphs, but there was a really nice study that split people into three groups of genetic risk. Mm-hmm. And people who are at the highest group of genetic risk, they looked at kind of three tiers of lifestyle, like healthy lifestyle. And those who had the best lifestyle but highest genetic risk had the same risk of heart disease as the people with the lowest genetic risk the worst lifestyle.
Oh, my.
So I think what that can kind of tell you is that if your genes are good, but, you know, you don't take care of yourself, you're at high risk of having problems. If your genes are bad and you take really good care of yourself, you know, you're at a much lower risk. So I think I take that as, yes, genetics play a role. No, there's nothing that we can do about that right now, maybe in the future. But what we can control is how we live and how much we move and how we eat and the choices that we make. So I tend to have people focus on that because that's obviously something that's within our control.
And I want to confirm that I think people get nervous about I can never have any fun anyway if I have to eat so perfectly. But I want you to confirm if you feel this way, that it's an overall good eating, right? Do you have a decent breakfast? Do you have in general good lunches or dinners or X amount of fruits and vegetables a day? Not if you sneak off one weekend and have a plate of nachos. that's maybe not going to kill you. I just want to make sure that that's not, you know, that's what you're talking about, is just overall good, healthy, mostly balanced diet. And
yeah, no, very good point. And maybe that's a really good misconception that you have this perfect diet, and if you can't maintain it, what's the point? No, I don't believe that. I think that everyone has room in their current diet. Everyone has room for improvement, right?
And so, yes.
Yeah. So, and I in my visits, I go through a, you know, a full day's diet, typical, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner. You know, and we look at things where, you know, maybe what are one or two things that could be adjusted to give the most benefit. You know, and everyone has something, and usually what we try to find is something that's not too painful for them to give up, but is still, you know, a healthy choice. So I think it certainly doesn't have to be an all or nothing. I think that eating is so much more, meals, sharing meals with others is so much more than just, you know, getting your calories for the day. Mm-hmm. You know, it's part of society, it's part of our culture, and how you share meals with others and what you enjoy is also important. And being miserable and eating perfectly, I don't know that that's a healthy, you know, happy way to live. So I never advocate for that. I always, you know, talk with people, come up with a plan, a compromise where, you know, we can get the most benefit without, you know, compromising happiness.
I need to take another short station break.
Prepare for an Afrofuturistic journey when KFAI brings you the Jake Blount Trio, Saturday, March 29th at the Cedar Cultural Center. Jake Blount's latest release, The New Faith, is a modern spiritual filled with outrage, salvation, and hope. His unstaged performances are carefully crafted to resonate with the audience. Because the more we learn about where we've been, the better equipped we are to face the future. Opening the show is Minneapolis's own Joe Rainey. Tickets for the Jake Blount Trio can be found at the Cedar Cultural Center website. Visit thecedar.org for more details.
You're tuned to KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, and KFAI.org. This is Disability in Progress. I'm Sam Jasmine. We're speaking with Dr. Jeremy Vantoff, talking about heart disease in adults and other heart conditions. I guess it all kind of is a disease in a way. I'm wondering if heart disease, can it lead to cognitive impairment?
It can, yes. So especially with the heart failure type of heart disease, you know, this is where your heart acts as a pump, right?
Right.
And it's not, in heart failure, it's not pumping as efficiently and strongly as it's supposed to. So when that happens, you're not moving as much blood and oxygen through the body, and different organs can suffer from not enough blood flow. And, you know, the brain is one of those organs. So sometimes people with heart failure can feel kind of groggy or brain fog or things like that. That's certainly related to their heart failure and their heart disease.
Ah, and so how do you know if it's just like a maybe dementia type thing or something, or if it's really heart disease? You go to your doctor and get it checked?
Yeah, and the way that dementia presents is often different than the way a heart failure type of cognitive issue would present. Dementia is, there's a lot of short-term memory, you know, loss with dementia, whereas with the decreased blood flow, it's kind of just a global, more confused or feeling slower than usual.
Ah, yes. And so what role do medications then and treatments play in treatment of diseases? I'm wondering because I think that you hear sometimes about, well, you may have to go on medications and then there's these side effects, and that scares me. You know, the idea everything has a side effect, and how do you balance those side effects with what you want to get out of your treatment? So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, you know, one of the benefits of being in cardiology and working with the heart is that we have a lot of data to support the decisions that we make. So there are a lot of conditions where there are very clear benefits with certain classes of medications. Mm-hmm. You know, heart failure is one where we have multiple medications. If there's a blocked artery or a narrowing in the artery, we have several medications that have been shown to slow down that progression. If there's a heart arrhythmia, we have medications that help decrease those arrhythmias and help people feel better. So there's a lot of good data supporting a lot of these treatments. But as you said, medications come with potential side effects. Mm-hmm. And that has to be balanced with the benefit that you receive from them. The majority of people can find, you know, a regimen that can provide them with benefit without, you know, lifestyle limiting side effects. Sometimes it can take a few different trials and dose adjustments and in multiple visits over time. I think that's important to acknowledge that all of our bodies are different. How we metabolize medications is different. The effect of one medication on one person isn't the same as the other. Mm-hmm. So it does take sometimes multiple attempts and adjustments. So it's important to find, you know, a cardiologist or a provider who can go through all those changes, you know, with you as a patient. And then also, you know, as a patient, understanding that, you know, if there are side effects, to advocate for yourself and let them know that this is what you're feeling. But then also, you know, being patient with the process and going through and trying different options. Because at the end of the day, the goal is, you know, not only to help people live longer, but to help them live well. And often we can find, you know, we can find a balance.
Can you talk about some of the advancements in technology that you're seeing come up? You know, we have the pacemaker. We have now. I'm hearing, you know, more about like how close are we to really perfecting the pig heart to be able to be a heart transplant? And how are the heart transplants doing? Talk a little bit about the technology side.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, it's a very exciting area, you know, to be in and to talk about. I think some of the advancements that we've seen over the last, you know, several years are different options for heart valve replacements, mm-hmm. Different types of valves, less invasive ways to, you know, fix a heart valve, which can be more attractive for folks who are maybe a little more sick or are really hesitant to go through a big, you know, cardiac bypass, open chest surgery. So I think we've seen a lot of development in valves. Heart transplant is always an important field where things like finding different methods to help maintain the new heart that's coming from one place to another. That's an important thing because time is always of the essence there.
Right.
So there are advancements there. I think routine use of, you know, non-human hearts for transplants is probably is far away still. I'll admit that is not my area of expertise. I'm not a transplant doctor. Mm-hmm. But I think we're still a ways away from that. What we are seeing more of, and we've seen over the past, you know, several years, are different, you know, artificial heart pumps.
Ah, right? Yes.
That kind of take over the pumping function of the heart and, you know, are implanted in a person's body. And it's like a little motor. So we've seen developments in that over time, which is a, you know, an amazing technology.
And they work well?
Not as well as a human heart, right?
Well, but, right.
but better than, better than a heart that isn't pumping at all. And of course, it's not a simple technology, and it's not a simple process. So it's something that should be very carefully considered with a specialist.
I'd like to take a step back. I hear about situations where people, throughout their life, they get sick. Maybe they get cancer, maybe they go through a treatment. I'm thinking about even certain chemotherapies that totally help the person, go into remission or recover from whatever they do. But then the person gets told, oh, by the way, this particular treatment carries a long-term possibility of you having, heart problems later because of how it changes maybe the mitochondria or whatever in your heart. Can you talk a little bit about that? How does that happen? And what if a person hears that, what can they do to change or help themselves not fall into being that possibility of it doing something bad to your heart?
Yeah, really important question, especially as the treatments for cancer have rapidly advanced over time, and many options are available, acknowledging that there are risks to that as well. Heart-related risks are certainly present. Some of the older chemotherapy medications were notorious for causing weak heart or heart failure. I think that risk is pretty well recognized now, and we can monitor people very closely, getting ultrasounds of their heart to make sure that the heart function is still normal. Other medications can cause heart arrhythmias, or they can increase blood pressure, which can lead to heart disease over time. So I think what the most important thing is to, partner with a physician who's able to monitor for those side effects and those risks. Mm-hmm. And if you're a person who, has had heart disease in the past or is at high risk for heart disease for any number of reasons, there are specialists in cardiology who actually specialize in the interaction between cancer treatment and heart disease. And it's a field called cardio-oncology. And there are specialists who spend extra time with those patients and help understand the risks involved.
Okay, then. That's good to know. What advice do you have for caregivers who might be supporting somebody with a heart condition?
I think that, going back to the lifestyle kind of adjustments that we talked about, I think it's really important, especially if the caregiver is someone who lives with the patient, that kind of everyone is on board with a heart healthy approach to life, right? Because if the heart patient is trying to make changes, it can be really difficult if the person across the table is not making those changes.
Right.
So I really encourage families to make changes together. Whether it's eating patterns or activity or your roommate smokes, it's important you approach this as a team. So that's one. I think another point, going back to your question about misconceptions, is that it's the vast majority of people with heart disease, it's safe for them to do activities. Having a heart disease diagnosis does not mean that you are destined to, sit quietly for the rest of your life. It's often very safe and actually beneficial and important for people with heart disease, to get up and keep moving and maintain strength and endurance. There are certainly exceptions, and heart patients should talk with their doctors about, what they can and cannot do. But the vast majority can still, can still do activities. So I think as a caregiver, that's often a concern or a worry that I hear, that, so-and-so tried to go out and do this activity today, and I was really worried about it, and I told them to go back in the house and sit down. And often, actually, what they're doing is okay. So I think that's an important thing to remember.
And I feel like sometimes there can be a crossover, too, where the person who is recovering from the heart condition, they're nervous. So they might limit themselves because they feel like, oh, if I could have this happen again anytime, what should I do? Maybe I shouldn't overexert. Maybe I shouldn't, you know. So there must be some kind of careful balance. How can people find out more about what to do, what not to do? And where can they go for good information?
Yeah, great. I think this is a great opportunity for me to plug cardiac rehabilitation because this is something that's offered to anyone who has a heart attack, who has a stent placed, you know, who has to be in the hospital for heart failure, you know, would qualify or have chest pain that isn't going away. They would qualify for cardiac rehabilitation. And what this means is this is a structured, organized rehabilitation program with exercise that where the patient is monitored. They wear heart leads, so you can monitor their heart rate and monitor their blood pressure, that you look at their heart rhythm. And what they can do is slowly advance you over time to make sure that as you do more and more rigorous activity, everything still looks safe and good. So I think cardiac rehabilitation is super helpful resource for people with heart disease.
If I can just stick one more thing in real quickly. I feel like, you know, people think of themselves, if I have high blood pressure, I may have heart problems. If I have really good blood pressure, I'm not going to have any problems. Is that really true? Or can they still have heart conditions with good blood pressure? Is it more dependent on how their you know, how the numbers are for them?
Yeah. So what I like to talk about with patients in clinic is that when we think about heart health and risk, we have to consider the whole picture. Mm-hmm. I think it's easy to narrow in on one specific, you know, what is the cholesterol number? What is the blood pressure number? You know, what is the blood sugar number? Mm-hmm. And really focus in on that. But risk and future cardiovascular health really has to do with, you know, everything considered together. So let's say someone has perfect blood pressure, you know, it's always under control, but they have diabetes and have a really hard time controlling their blood sugar. That person is at high risk, right? Mm. Or vice versa, their blood pressure is great, no diabetes, super active, but they have a gene mutation that causes their cholesterol to be, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 times the normal limit. Mm. You know, that person has a high risk. You know, so I think you really need to take in the whole picture. And it's great if some of the risk factors are well controlled, but if the others are not, you know, you may still be at high risk.
Dr. Van Dorf, I want to just thank you so much for giving us your time today and speaking with us on this important topic. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with?
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, Sam. I think that what I would say is that as we started off, heart disease is not inevitable. There's always something that someone can do to set themselves up for a better heart health in the future. And if there are questions about that, there are those of us out there who are interested in helping out.
Thank you again so much for being on with us.
Thank you.
We need to take a short station break and we'll be right back.
See the light when the Blind Boys of Alabama take the stage at the Dakota Thursday, April 3rd. From their Recording Academy Lifetime Achievement Award to their 6 Grammys to their induction into the Gospel Music Hall of Fame, the Blind Boys of Alabama are living legends in every sense of the word. Torn with their latest release, Echoes of the South, every song reverberates with their signature blend of gospel, soul, country, and rock into the transcendent songs of faith and hope. Tickets for the Blind Boys of Alabama can be found at the Dakota website. Visit DakotaCooks.com for more details.
Fellas, I said that's it.
You've been listening to KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. This is Disability in Progress. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of director. We've been speaking with Dr. Jeremy Van Toff. Dr. Van Toff is an assistant professor of the University of Minnesota Medical School and a cardiologist of M Health Fairview. Dr. Van Toff also has research interest involves in improving cardiovascular disease detection and early intervention. My name is Sam. I've been the host of this show. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you'd like to be on my email list, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@sumjasmine.com. And you can also suggest ideas for future shows. Charlene Dahl is my research PR person. Bye, Charlene.
Bye.
Aaron is my podcaster. Thanks so much for what you do, Aaron. And thank you, listener, for supporting us.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Immigrant communities in Minnesota are experiencing an increased presence of ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, as the current administration moves forward with its mandate to expand deportations.
ICE has always been active in various places, including Minnesota. And so part of what we are seeing now, I think, is also just a closer attention being paid to might that official vehicle be ICE and what should we do about it?
That's Julia Decker, Policy Director at the Immigration Law Center in Minnesota, a nonprofit organization that provides free immigration legal representation to low-income immigrants and refugees in Minnesota and North Dakota.
So there's a lot of different working tables that are happening between like us and other partners, legal service organizations. We sort of call it the hub. We are doing community education and trainings around knowing your rights, as well as just educating the general public about the immigration system.
Their educational training provides information on how to respond when encountering immigration officers in various situations.
If a person is identifying themselves as an ICE or law enforcement official, you have a right not to open the door if they don't have a warrant and that they don't have a warrant that's signed by a judge. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to ask for an attorney.
The crackdown on immigration enforcement is also making its way to the state capital. Representative Max Reimer, Republican from District 28B, has introduced a bill that will prohibit any state official from interfering with federal immigration agents. Here is Representative Reimer presenting the bill at the March 12 Public Safety Committee hearing.
This bill, it accomplishes two main things. The first is that it mandates any illegal immigrant arrested on suspicion of a violent crime, even in cases where the county attorney elects not to prosecute, be reported to ICE. Secondly, this bill prevents state and local entities from actively prohibiting, restricting, or interfering with federal immigration authorities in carrying out the federal immigration enforcement. What the motive is for this bill is to open up a line of communication between local authorities and dealing with dangerous criminals who should not be in our community.
During the hearing, the bill received response from committee members, including Representative Athena Hollins from District 66B.
And what I'm concerned about is, in my experience, people use the lack of documentation for immigrants as a weapon. When a man has a child with a woman who is undocumented, he uses her status as a weapon against her. And so when I look at this bill, I'm looking at Section 2 which is not about violent offenders. It's simply about the state, any city or county official, not allowed to withhold information from ICE.
An encounter with immigration officers can be just the beginning of a complicated legal process. Julia Decker explains.
So when somebody is arrested, eventually they will end up in a detention center either that's either run by ICE through a private company or in a county jail or state facility that contracts with ICE to hold people for an immigration custody, which is confusing sometimes because immigration detention is civil detention, even though it's happening maybe in the same facility as people who are incarcerated for crimes. But I think it's important to emphasize that people who are detained by ICE, whether it's a county jail or a private facility, are not under criminal detention.
Some of the recommendations for immigrant communities are to memorize phone numbers and have resources available on hand, like the Immigration Law Center of Minnesota Intake and Detention Hotline or the Immigration Hub Training Schedule, which can be found at ilcm.org.
Getting an attorney is also really important. The government will not provide one in immigration proceedings, unlike in regular criminal cases. There's no like public defender model.
As the current administration continues reshaping immigration enforcement nationwide, immigrant communities in Minnesota are turning to local nonprofit organizations and community resources for guidance and support. For North Star Stories, I'm Victor Palomino.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the State of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
Summer soft, wakes you up with a kiss to start the morning off. In the midst of herself playing Santa Claus, she brings gifts through her breeze. Morning rain gently plays her rhythms on your windowpane, giving you no clue of when she plans to change to bring rain or sunshine. And so you wait to see what she'll do. It's snowing.